So thank all of you very much for coming today evening for this talk on spirituality in the age of science. Am I audible to you behind? Thank you. So I'll start with an anecdote. Once a group of 10 friends came from a small town to a big city. They had come for a picnic, an outing over there. And they got a room in a hotel that was a skyscraper, 100-story. And they got a room at the 100th floor. So they went in by the elevator, kept their luggage, and came back and came out to see the sights in the city. When they came back, to their dismay, they found that the power had got disconnected. There was no power. That meant there was no elevator functioning. And they had to climb up 100 stories. Now, as they were contemplating this onerous prospect, they got the idea. One of them got the idea. Let us entertain each other by telling stories. Each of us can tell a story. And if it is long enough to last for about 10 floors, then by the time 10 stories are over, we'll reach the 100th floor. They all agreed. And they started. Some of them told a little longer story. So by the time the 10th person's turn came, they had actually come to the 95th floor. And they all told, tell your story now. The 10th person said, no, I cannot tell my story. Why? It's a tragedy. If you hear it, it will shatter your hearts. Come on, tell it. No, I can't tell it. As this yes and no is going on, they climbed up 96, 97, 98. I can't tell the story. No, you must tell the story. We have all told the story. And finally, they came to the 100th floor in front of their room door. And he said, now I have to tell you the story. I have forgotten the key downstairs. So, actually, we live in an age where we have seen phenomenal ascent in human scientific knowledge. You know, what to speak of? If we compare today's world with 500 years ago, even 50 years ago, much of the technology that we have today would have been unimaginable. If we had told people 50 years ago that you just press some buttons on some small object and you can talk with anyone, any part of the world, they would have considered fantasy. So we have climbed up the skyscraper of scientific knowledge at a phenomenal speed in the last few centuries, and especially the last few decades. And yet, despite having enormous technology and the comfort and ease which it brings to life, something seems to be missing. Actually, since all of you are at a height, I had a PowerPoint here. You may not be able to see the details, but you might be able to see the broad things that are there over here. Is this visible to you from there? You may be able to read some things. I'll explain some things also if you're not able to read. Okay. Is this better? Is it better? Okay. Thank you. So, Martin Luther King has said that our scientific power has outrun our spiritual power. Now, we have guided missiles and misguided men. So now, what is he referring to when he's saying this? It can refer to a broad variety of things. I'll focus on one aspect that ultimately, you know, people climb up, these 5-10 friends, they climb up the skyscraper. Their purpose is not to entertain themselves. Their purpose is not just to go to a big height. Their purpose is to go home, to get home, get to the room where they are staying and be comfortable there. So like that, whatever we do in life, we ultimately want happiness. And we are far more comfortable than we were in the past in terms of facilities, gadgets. But unfortunately, we are comfortably unhappy. We are comfortably unhappy. That means at a physical level, there is a lot of comfort. But internally, there's unhappiness. And this is borne out by various statistics. You know, the World Health Organization has said the mental health problems are going to be the biggest problems of the current century. And while mental health can have a broad spectrum that it refers to, the most tragic among them is suicide. According to WHO statistics, 1 million people commit suicide every year. This figure of 1 million amounts to one suicide every 40 seconds. That means since I started this talk, around 10 to 15 people have already committed suicide. This figure 1 million is actually more than the number of people who are killed in wars, in terrorist attacks, in murderous crimes, all combined together. When there is one terrorist attack and there is global concern about how to combat terrorism. But more than the number of people who are being killed by others are the number of people who are killing themselves. So why is it? Why is it that people are destroying themselves? Now, there have always been problems in life throughout history. And yet, the sheer number of people wanting to end their own lives is historically unprecedented. And this is unprecedented not in a positive way, it is in a tragic way. So the yoga texts, which are an ancient body of spiritual wisdom from India, they explain that we are at our core spiritual beings. I'll explain what that means a little later. But to illustrate what has gone wrong in today's world, they say that as spiritual beings, if we live materialistically, we are underutilizing our potential. And that underutilization not only leads to we not tapping our potential, but it backfires. So, an example to illustrate this. Suppose somebody has lived in a village where the only vehicle they ever saw was a tractor. And the tractor is used for plowing. And suppose somehow a friend comes along and gives them a Mercedes-Benz. And they take the Mercedes-Benz and start plowing a field. Now, if somebody starts plowing a field with the Mercedes, what is going to happen? Two things. You know, the field will get spoiled and the car will get spoiled. Neither the field will get plowed, nor the car will serve any constructive purpose. So what the yoga text says is that our human life is meant to offer us higher, unending spiritual happiness. Just like a Mercedes-Benz is meant to take us on a smooth drive across a long distance. But when we use the human life primarily for seeking materialistic pleasures, then we end up using, in a situation similar to a person, using a Mercedes for plowing. So, when we use human life for materialism, two things happen. The environment gets spoiled, like the field getting spoiled, and our own body-mind also gets spoiled. So now, climate change is a serious matter of concern nowadays. And more people are becoming green conscious, are trying to become green conscious. Now, there are various causes of climate change, but certainly the human element is significant. And this is acknowledged not just by, this is not just pointed out by spiritualists, but even skeptics or even atheists for that matter. They have pointed it out. One of the most prominent biologists, E.O. Wilson, he is himself an atheist. He says he did a survey of the interdependence of various species on the planet. And he found that every species contributes to the ecology of the planet, to the balance, ecological balance in the planet, in some small or big way. If any species becomes extinct, that destabilizes the ecological balance. But curiously enough, there is one species, if it became extinct, there would be no problem for the ecology. In fact, most ecological problems would be solved if that species became extinct. Any guesses which species that is? Yeah, we humans. Now, this is embarrassing to say the very least. Now, we humans are often considered to be the pinnacle of evolution, to be the most intelligent species among all species. Now, if we have a class and in which, you know, the particular student is the most brilliant student in the class, then we would expect the most brilliant student to make a constructive contribution. But if the most brilliant student, actually, if expelling the student from the class would make the class better, I think something is wrong here. What's going wrong? Isn't it? So it's something like that. Humans are the most intelligent species, and yet it is humans who are harming the ecology more than any other species. So why is that? What is it that is going wrong? Just as a Mercedes used for plowing spoils the field, so the yoga texts say that metaphorically, that when we humans live materialistically, we actually, in the quest for pleasure, we indiscriminately exploit natural resources. And this indiscriminate exploitation comes because we have at our core a natural longing for happiness. And this comes from our core, this longing comes from our core because at our spiritual essence, we are actually meant to be happy. So, because of that, we will seek happiness, but when we seek happiness by indiscriminate exploitation of natural resources, we disrupt the ecological balance. Similarly, when we live materialistically, what happens is the body-mind, the body-mind is like the car in this case, the body-mind also gets damaged. Now, much of the suffering in today's world is actually self-induced. Now, if we consider addictions. Now, in nature also we see there are living beings which get trapped by their own actions. You know, a fish is caught by a bait, or a mouse may get caught in a mouse trap by some cheese. But the mice or the fish have excuses. You know, their bait looks like food, and they don't know in advance that it's a trap. You know, a cigarette doesn't look like food to anyone, isn't it? And who doesn't know in advance that cigarette smoking is injurious to health? And yet, millions of people smoke and hurt themselves. So, the excuses that the fish and the mice have, we humans don't have, unfortunately. So, there's an old Egyptian saying which is put on the one of the pyramids. Now, there were, during the reign of the pharaohs, there was a Epicurean period where some of the kings were, you know, in today's term, we could call them gluttons. And they tried to circumvent nature. Nature, we may think, oh, I want to eat good food. Fine, we can eat good food. But nature limits our capacity. Our stomach has a particular capacity beyond which we can't eat. So they thought they would trick nature. So they had their golden or jewel or silver plates in which they would get a feast. They would eat it to their heart's content. And then after that, when the stomach was full, they would have another silver bowl in which they would have painless vomiting pills provided by their physicians. And they would eat that pill and vomit everything out. And after vomiting everything out, would eat again. And they did that, so desperate, you're trying to get some enjoyment through eating. And now, it's not just eating and enjoying, it's not just a matter of how much, whether the stomach is empty or not. Eating means the whole body, the alimentary canal has to take in the food and then take out the food. The body cannot sustain that. Those who tried that for a generation or so, they died very young. And thereafter, they didn't repeat that experiment. So, in that connection, a saying came up that it said that 1/4 of what you eat maintains you. The remaining 3/4 maintains your physician. The remaining three-fourth maintains your physician. So actually, quite often, many problems that we get are, we need food to eat, but overeating causes a wide variety of problems. So now here what is happening? Our suffering again is self-induced. Now, of course, obesity can sometimes be genetic. It can have many complicated factors, but there are various factors involved in it. But the important thing is that a lot of problems are caused by eating. So the underlying point that I am making is, when we live materialistically, then we damage the environment and we damage our own body and mind. And science is basically providing us tools for doing what we want to do. So if we have a materialistic vision of life, then science will accelerate our journey on the self-destructive course. So it is with the technological tools that we have developed through science that much of the devastation of the ecology is happening. It is through the technological tools that are provided through science. I'm not blaming science here. I'm not blaming science at all. I'm simply making the point that science is a value neutral tool. And whatever conception we have of life, whatever definition we have of happiness, based on that, we will use science. So science is actually used to promote the same through advertisements, through technology, through advertisements that promote many of the products that hurt us, that damage us. So here, the materialistic definition of life or the materialistic definition of happiness is something which causes the ecology harm and something which causes us, our body-mind complex, also some harm. So there is, the yoga texts describe, a better way to live, a more fulfilling way to find happiness. And that is based on a more complete understanding of who we are. So as I discussed this earlier, how at the body level, body and mind level, there's depression, addiction, there's self-destruction. So the Bhagavad Gita is an ancient yoga text, and it offers a three-level model of the self. So just like in a computer system, there is a computer, there is the hardware, there is the software and the user. So like that, there is the body, there is the mind, and there is the soul. The body is like the hardware, the mind is like the software, and the soul is like the user. Now, there has to be proper coordination between all these three. If I may have the most high-tech computer, but if the software is corrupted, the virus has infected the computer, then the hardware becomes useless, no matter how good the hardware may be. And I may tinker with the hardware. No, maybe replace the monitor, replace the motherboard, replace the battery. May spend a lot of money doing that. But if the problem is in the software, changing the hardware will not solve the problem. So like that, similarly, the mind, just as in the software there can be viruses which corrupt the software, similarly in the mind, there can be misleading conceptions. There can be misdirected desires. There can be negative thought patterns. And these become like the virus that corrupt the mind. And when the mind is corrupted, at that time, no matter how good the hardware, no matter how good the body, no matter how good the physical facilities that we have, still we cannot find happiness because the software of the mind is corrupted. So technological advancement, it focuses on making the hardware better and better, making the body, providing more and more things for the body and for physical gratification. But if the mind is corrupted, then nothing can provide us happiness. Now, if it's hot, you know, we may sweat because of the heat. And then if you have air conditioning, we won't sweat. But, you know, if there is stress inside, Now, I will sweat in the air conditioning, not because of heat, but because of anxiety. So the problems of the hardware cannot be, problems of software cannot be solved by improving the hardware. Similarly, the corruption at the level of the mind, that cannot be solved simply by scientific progress which improves technology, which uses more, better and better technological gadgets. So the yoga text explained that spirituality is also a science. Not a science exactly in the way we understand it, but it's a higher dimensional science. Is this visible? I was planning to draw this. Just as science has two limbs, there is theory and there is experiment. So at the level of theory, we propose maybe Newton saw fruit falling and why did this fruit fall? Because maybe there is a theory of gravity, maybe there is gravity, a force which causes things to get attracted to each other. And then there is experiment which tries to prove or disprove the theory. So just as in science, there is theory and experiment. Similarly, here in spirituality, there is philosophy and there is religion. So philosophy is like the theoretical aspect, where philosophy gives us propositions. Okay, for example, the three-level model of the self, which I just talked about, that is a proposition. There is a proposition in the philosophy that our existence is physical, mental, and spiritual. Now, this is at the level of theory, we can't know for sure whether it is right or wrong. The experiment is important. So the experiment in the spiritual realm is religion. And the word religion has quite a negative connotation. And many people say that, I'm spiritual but not religious. SBNR is the group of people they call them. That's because religion is often associated nowadays with narrow-mindedness, with fanaticism, with intolerance. And I'll come to that part. But what religion in its original purpose is meant to be is a set of practices that give us experience of higher reality, that prepare our consciousness to explore and experience higher reality, experience spiritual reality. That is what religion is meant to be. Now, there can be misdirect. So when spirituality is understood this way as a higher science, as a higher dimensional science, then through philosophy and religion, through the integration of these two limbs, it can bring about inner transformation. It can enable us to experience higher happiness. But before that, this combination is often fragmented. So Srila Prabhupada was a great modern day saint. He is one of the most prominent commentators on the Bhagavad Gita. So he explained the relationship. He said, if we have philosophy without religion, then it is just mental speculation. Mental speculation means anybody can come and say, maybe it is like this, maybe it is like that. I believe this, I believe that, I propose this, I propose that. And at the level of abstract philosophy, there is no end. You know, anybody can prove anything and anybody can try to counter and disprove anything. It just becomes a game of argument, counter-argument and counter-counter-argument, where there is no end to it. Some people say that, okay, I'm skeptical, I don't believe anything. That's fine, being skeptical is good, because if you're skeptical, then we won't be carried away by misleading ideas. But skepticism can only tell us what is wrong. Skepticism will never tell us what is right. If I'm skeptical, this is not right. 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 But then what is right? At some point of time, I have to give up my skepticism and I have to move forward. Only then I'll find out what is right. So if it's just abstract philosophy without any practical implementation in things, then what the result is? It's just mental speculation. Conversely, if there is religion without philosophy, if there is religion without philosophy, then that leads to sentimentalism or fanaticism. Thank you. As it leads to sentimentalism or fanaticism. Sentimentalism means people just start accept anything and everything. They say, oh, it feels good, I do it. But they don't explore intellectually. So it can be sentimental or it can become fanatical. Fanatical means that my way is the only way. If you're not following my way, you're going to go to hell. And there are some extreme fanatics who say, not only are you going to go to hell, we will help you get there faster. So, now fanaticism is a result of a lack of philosophical understanding. So, when there is an understanding of higher spiritual, intellectual understanding of higher spiritual reality, then, and there is practical application of it, then it's a combination. It's like if I go to a doctor, a doctor gives a diagnosis and the doctor gives a prescription. So now, if I just get the prescription without a diagnosis, I won't feel very inspired. Why should I take this? You know, I don't think anything is wrong with me. Why should I take this? But if the doctor just gives me a diagnosis and don't give me any prescription, what do I do with it? Doctor tells me that I got some disease, now you can go. Tell me what to do. So we need both. So the philosophy gives us like the diagnosis. And the religion gives us the prescription. But now when we go to a doctor, at that time, you know, doctor will tell us, okay, you take this medicine. But suppose the patient has gone to 100 doctors. And then the patient starts saying, okay, no, I went to this doctor and he said that maybe I should take this medicine. I went to that doctor and she said like this. Now this patient just starts repeating 100 opinions like this. The doctor will say, forget it all. Just take the prescription that I am giving you. That will cure you. Now the purpose of this is not to reject all other doctors. The purpose of this is simply to create a focus. Similarly, when we are exploring the spiritual path, there are many paths to grow spiritually. But when we come to a particular path, if at that time we start keep analyzing, okay, what about this, what about that, what about that? We need to get our questions answered. But after the questions are answered, ultimately, the patient needs to take medicine. Without that, the patient will not experience any cure. So like that, eventually, after we get a basic intellectual understanding, there has to be some practice. That practice is what transforms. So now this transformation is that practically incorporating religion in one's life, does it benefit people? So now, of course, we see today's world that there's terrorism and there's violence in the name of religion. These are very visible and very tragic results of a fragmented approach to religion where it becomes fanatical. But many researchers have shown, this is the Oxford University Press, they compiled three researchers, Koenig, McCullough and Larson. They actually took 2,000 published studies from all over the world. They did, not only did they do their own studies, but they took 2,000 studies which had already been done and published in journals all over the world, looking at the correlation between religion and health. And what did they find? And they compiled it in the book called the Handbook of Religion and Health. And they found that people who attended a spiritual program once a week, now they lived 7 years longer than their non-believing counterparts. So at one level, longevity increase. It's as a correlation with religious belief. And not only longevity, but also the quality of life. Religious youth showed significantly lower levels of alcohol abuse, premature sexual involvement, criminal delinquency, and suicidal tendencies than their non-religious counterparts. So here, earlier we talked about self-destructive behavioral patterns. So those were significantly lower. And not only among the young, even among the elderly. Elderly people with deep personal religious faith have a stronger sense of well-being and life satisfaction than their less religious peers. And overall, their conclusion was, a high SQ faithfulness to God appears to benefit all benefit people of all educational levels and ages. So SQ refers to spiritual quotient. It's like we have IQ, intellectual quotient, EQ, emotional quotient. SQ is spiritual quotient. So high SQ faithfulness to God means not just a sentimental idea that I believe in God, but a intellectually based approach to God. It is beneficial. So now how does this happen? So I talked about spirituality as a higher dimensional science. And then philosophy gives us some postulates. Religion gives us some experiences. Then I quoted this study which says that religious practices seem to benefit people. So what exactly happens? How does it benefit? Now, religious practices are talked about in various traditions. In the yoga tradition, it is described that it is not just a matter of, you know, going to some religious place every week or believing in something. Rather, yoga is a process of inner exploration. Most of the times we associate yoga with certain postures, you know, sitting in certain postures for improving the health or for improving the figure, which is fine, but those postures are the launching pad for raising our consciousness. It's like, I come from India, where people are mad for cricket. In America, many people, I don't know now, for people, cricket refers to an insect, not a game. So, anyway, I think so. A similar game here is baseball. So, you have a batter, you call it batter or batsman?
Batter.
Batter, okay. So, now different batters, they stand in different postures. When the ball is going to come, some people may stand with their legs apart, some people may stand with their legs very close to each other, some people may stand with the bat upraised, some people may stand with the bat near the ground. Now, all these postures, they have a purpose. When the ball comes, you know, the person may have a very stylish posture, but if the ball just zooms by, then what is the use of the posture? The posture is meant to be able to hit the ball forcefully and effectively when the ball is launched, ball comes. So, the posture itself is not the end. The posture is meant to launch the ball into a distant trajectory towards the boundary. So, similarly, yoga offers a certain postures. And the postures are meant to launch the consciousness. Launch the consciousness upwards towards spiritual levels of reality. And yoga is also, I talked about philosophy and religion. So, using the word religion broadly, yoga involves religious practices. They are practices which give us experience of higher reality. So, modern science is experimental. Why experimental in the sense that we can keep the object outside us and we can subject it to experiments. But here, it is we who want to subject ourselves to the experiment. So, it is our consciousness that becomes like the laboratory. And within that, we experience, when we subject ourselves to spiritual stimuli, when we undergo spiritual practices, we observe, does my consciousness change? What happens to me? Do I experience peace? Do I experience clearing of my consciousness? Do I become calmer? Do I become more joyful? And so it's an experiment that is performed in the laboratory of our consciousness. And that's why it's experiential. It's not experimental. And whereas science requires controlled experiments, you know, if somebody wants to study the properties of a particular chemical, then, or they want to study, okay, this particular medicine, how does it cure people? Then when they are giving the medicine to the subjects, they'll make sure that that subject doesn't take anything else which will either aggravate the disease or cure the disease. It's a controlled environment. So science focuses on controlled experiments. Similarly, when we practice yoga, because it's our own consciousness that is the arena of the experiment. So, there is not control experiment, but experiences through self-control. When we redirect our consciousness spiritually by regulating material indulgence, then our consciousness opens to spiritual experience. Now, when our consciousness opens to spiritual experience, what exactly happens? Going back to the earlier example of the software, so, spiritual practices are like the antivirus program for the mind. So, basically, when we say the mind becomes corrupted, what does happens? The mind gets some wrong definitions of happiness. When a person has become addict of something, basically, they have associated happiness with some activity which is actually causing them misery. The activity which is causing the misery, they think it's giving me happiness. And that's how they got the wrong definition of happiness. So, spiritual practices give us access to higher happiness. And thus, the lure of lower pleasures becomes more resistible. In that sense, it acts as an antivirus program. So, when we do meditation, just now at the start of this talk, what we did was mantra meditation. Basically, it's singing. But the purpose is to focus the consciousness on spiritual sound. And the essence of meditation is not just, again, sitting in a particular posture. But the essence of meditation is to direct our consciousness from the material to the spiritual. So, within us, often there are conflicts. I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to do that, I want to do that. But there are so many desires which are always going on in our mind. So, for example, you know, if we are reading some page on the net. Now, usually, almost everywhere on the net, if you are reading one page, there are often a dozen links nearby. And the idea of any website, any newspaper, news site, or any site that we visit, they want us to read more and more pages. So, we are reading one page and we see another link. Click, we go there. And we go there, we go there. And like that, often sometimes, you know, if we are watching some movies or seeing some pictures, sometimes what is supposed to be done for 1 or 2 minutes, we might end up doing for hours. So, then we wonder, why did I waste so much time? So, surfing on the net becomes suffering on the net. So, now imagine that if there were some website which had such technology that if we just glanced at a link, that link would open up. We don't even have to click it. When we are reading something, we glance at the link, immediately that link opens up. Then we would get lost. You know, if I look someone, immediately it pops up. Immediately it pops up. Immediately it pops up. We would get distracted completely. Our mind is like that kind of browser page. So right now, for example, say you are sitting and you are hearing. I am sitting and I am speaking. So while we are doing all this, in our mind there are many other links also. Oh, okay, what am I supposed to do after I go from here? I have to go and meet that person. But will that person come or not? You know, and maybe I should send them a message to make sure that they come on time. Hey, I got a message about 5 minutes ago. I didn't check it. Let me check it right now. And like that, so many thoughts keep coming. And in the mind, when one thought comes up, it just, if you just give it a little attention, it starts growing. And in that way, we're trying to do one thing, but we get distracted by other things. See, often when we plan our schedule, we may decide, okay, morning I want to do this, afternoon I want to do this, evening I'm going to do this. Every day we have time allotted for various activities. Often what we miss out is that our time is taken not just by our activities, but also by our thoughts. Also by our thoughts. Now, for example, if I come in a class and I see an acquaintance and I greet that acquaintance and that person just snubs me. Now that snubbing may happen in 10 seconds, but in the next whole hour, I'm seething with anger, you know. Imagining revenge fantasies, you know. Next time, how I'll snub that person in public view in front of everyone. So what happened? That one thought, it has consumed a full hour. And sometimes not just hour, it can take hours upon hours. So thoughts take time. And if our inner world is disorganized, then no matter how much well we plan our outer life, our plans will be sabotaged. So when there is friction within, I want to do this, but this thought is also coming. This desire is also coming. That plan is also coming up. That idea is also popping up. Then that inner friction dissipates our energy. And we can't function effectively. Now, students, most of you may have the experience. You sit in front of a book for 1 hour, and then maybe after 1 hour, some friend comes and says, hey, you're holding the book upside down. We didn't read anything over there. Because we are lost in our thoughts. So, what meditation does is, it minimizes inner friction. And therefore, it maximizes outer contribution. How does it minimize inner friction? Because when we practice meditation, we experience higher reality. In the experiencing higher spiritual reality, we get peace, we get stability, we get calmness. And then we are not so shaken by whatever is happening in the world. Whether it is anxiety about what may go wrong, or whether it is a lure of what pleasure lies ahead. Just like if I am in a boat, if somebody is in a sea, in the sea, then in the sea there are always going to be waves. The waves will keep moving the person up and down. But if that same person is in a boat and the boat is anchored, and the waves will still come, But the person will not be shaken so much because the boat is anchored to something much firmer. So like that, in our life, externally, pleasures, pain, anxieties, dreams, all of these will keep coming. But if we are spiritually anchored, then we'll be shaken less by these things. We'll be able to focus more. And by that greater focus, we will be able to achieve more. So spirituality enhances our ability to tap our ability. We all have talents, but if we are internally distracted, if we are not focused, then we cannot optimize our talents. We cannot use our talents well. Most of you probably know people who are talented, but they are distracted. They don't have the temperament to complement their talent. So actually, talent plus temperament leads to achievement. One has to have proper temperament. And the temperament can be boosted by spirituality. So, we're talking about spirituality in the age of science. So, science can make things better. In the external world, science can improve things in a significant way. Spirituality can make people better. Spirituality can make each of us a better person, better human being, a better person. Whatever avenue we explore in our life, if we become spiritual people, then we will be able to explore it better. We'll be able to do better justice to our talents. We'll be able to make more effective contributions in our life. And thus, by tapping both these aspects of human knowledge, scientific knowledge and spiritual knowledge, by tapping both of these, we can make the maximum contribution in our life. We can do the maximum justice to whatever abilities we have. And we can aspire towards fulfilling our dreams. I'll summarize. I started by talking about a topic, spirituality in the age of science. Science has phenomenally progressed, akin to this, the 10 friends climbing up a skyscraper, but forgetting the key downstairs. So like that, despite scientific progress, somehow the people are not happy. People are comfortably unhappy. So how is that? We discussed how mental health problems are the biggest health challenge, and more people are killing themselves than are being killed by others. These are both indicators that people are not happy themselves. So why is it that despite such inconceivable scientific progress, still there is so much unhappiness? So the spiritual yoga texts explain that this is because we are misdirecting our energies, like a Mercedes used for plowing. The Mercedes, when used for plowing, the field gets spoiled and the car also gets spoiled. Similarly, we human beings are meant to experience spiritual happiness, to grow spiritually. But when we live only materialistically, it's like using a Mercedes for plowing. So we spoil the environment. We discuss Yo Wilson saying that humans are made extinct, there will be no problem on the planet. In fact, ecological problems will be solved. So when we have a materialistic conception of life, then we indiscriminately exploit the ecology and thereby we harm it. And the body-mind, we are damaging the car. Body-mind are also getting damaged. We discussed how much of our human suffering is self-induced, like addictions especially, where we don't have to do things, but we indulge in the things which cause us harm. And of course, we discussed about mental problems before that. So, this is a Mercedes is meant for some higher purpose. So, we human beings are meant for pursuing spiritual growth and finding spiritual happiness. And in our connection discussed, what do we mean by spiritual? So, the Gita offers a three-level model of the self. Does anyone remember? What is the hardware?
Body.
The software? Body. The mind. And the user is the?
Soul.
Yeah, thank you. So then, we discussed how science, there is theory and experiment. Similarly, the spirituality there is? Does anyone remember? Philosophy and? Religion. Yeah, thank you. So, philosophy tells us that our self has this three-level model. So then, religion is not just a set of rituals, but it is meant to give us practices that give us experience of spiritual reality. And if these two limbs of spirituality, philosophy and religion, are not brought together, philosophy without religion, it is just mental speculation. Now, I think like this, you think like that, and we keep arguing endlessly. Skepticism can tell us what is wrong, but it can never tell us what is right. So, if there's, on the other hand, only religion without philosophy, then that is sentimentalism or fanaticism. Because then the religion becomes a part of the ego. Now, I am great, my religion is great. And everybody who thinks otherwise, they are a threat to me. So, both of these are because of fragmented approach to spirituality. When there is an integrated approach to spirituality, both philosophy and religion, then that brings out inner brings about inner transformation. And spirituality gives us access to higher happiness. And this is an experiential science. We conduct the we experience within the laboratory of our own consciousness through through self-control. And what do we experience? We experience peace, we experience happiness, we experience stability and security within. Because the spiritual realm is unchanging. It's like a boat which is anchored, it doesn't get shaken so much. Similarly, we don't get shaken so much. Spirituality acts like the antivirus program, which cleanses the mind of the harmful of the negative thought patterns, the harmful software. And just as a software problem cannot be cured by improving the hardware, similarly, mental problems cannot be solved simply by developing scientific technology and gadgets. We need spirituality for that. Spirituality gives us higher happiness and thereby makes us more capable of resisting self-defeating forms of pleasure. And then lastly, I discussed meditation maximizes outer contribution by minimizing inner friction. So our time is taken not just by our activities but also by our thoughts. The more our thoughts are disorganized, the more we cannot be effective. And meditation, connection with spirituality, brings organization in our inner world and brings focus. And thus, whatever abilities we have, we can tap those abilities more effectively through spirituality. So thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments?
I thought it was interesting that you have a separation between the body or the mind and soul. It's something that I hadn't really thought of, but I wonder if that's sort of a nature versus nurture argument as well. I guess it makes more sense in my head than it may in this outside real world, but I like that.
Yeah, thank you. So, I can address this a little bit. So, is it that when we talk about the separation of the body and the soul, is it something similar to the nature and nurture argument? Now, is it that we are just the way we are by nature, or can we change through nurture?
Well, I feel maybe, or at least what I get out of it, is that if you're, the soul is the user, that implies that there's a, the soul is the real driving force in manipulating it all, and then if the mind is just the, the software, so often we kind of associate the mind with who we are, and it kind of makes me just wonder about, if that's really just a framework that the soul operates within. I just like that as a...
That's true. See, when we identify with the mind, then we get swayed very easily. Because the mind is basically, when we identify with the body, then that which is outside the body, we think that is outside. That which is inside, I think that is me. But everything inside me is not me. Because many times we'll see that we do something, and then afterwards, why did I do that? Why did I do that? Sometimes we get angry with someone and just blast out at that person. And suppose that person records what we speak. And then after that, when we become calm and they show us, this is what you spoke. Really, I spoke that? How would I have spoken that? It's almost like some ghost entered into us and spoke through us. We feel like that. So what happens is that there are thoughts, desires in the mind, but the mind is not who we are. We are different from the mind. So we need to identify the mind, not identify with the mind. We need to identify the mind means what? That, for example, say I am studying and suddenly a thought comes. Oh, this is so difficult and you are so dumb. You will never do this. You will never be able to study. You are going to fail in your exams. Now, instead of getting discouraged, I can identify, hey, this is pessimistic. This is negative thinking. I don't have to think like this. So when I identify with it, then I become depressed by that. But instead of identifying with it, if I identify it, so then I can distance myself. Okay, this thinking is like this, but you know, I have studied, I have achieved till now, whatever I have achieved, and if I study more, I can achieve. So what we could do, what we need to do is, whatever is inside us, if we uncritically identify with that, then we sabotage ourselves. And especially when we start practicing the process of meditation, quite often when you try to meditate, it is not that we can easily focus. But when the mind gets distracted, at that time we become aware that actually I want to meditate, but there is something inside me which is going elsewhere. That means whatever is there inside me, that is not me. So that realization comes through meditation. And when that realization comes, then we become more alert to evaluating whatever thoughts pop up inside us. I'll give a simple example to illustrate this. You know, there are advertising agents. Who say, you know, why don't you take this cell phone? Why don't you take this gadget? Why don't you buy this new dress, new clothes? Why don't you buy this car? Whatever it is. Now, suppose we have decided, I'm not going to fall for these advertising agents. If I need something, I'll myself go and purchase it. As if somebody comes and markets something to me, I'm not going to take it. Now, just because I decide to stop purchasing doesn't mean that the advertiser will stop advertising. The advertisers are going to advertise still. And I have to consistently say no to them. I have to keep saying no to them. So just as there are external advertisers, we could consider the mind to be like an internal advertiser. So whatever we have enjoyed in the past, or whatever we have habituated ourselves to in the past, it is not even enjoyed. Because usually what happens when we do something new, we enjoy initially. But afterwards, it just becomes a habit. We don't even enjoy it much, but we still keep doing it again and again. So whatever we are habituated to, the mind starts promoting it. Hey, why don't you do that? Why don't you go and eat something? Why don't you go and drink something? Why don't you go and watch a movie? Why don't you go here? Why don't you go there? So when that desire comes up, it's basically just like an external advertiser telling, why don't you purchase this? It's like the mind is saying, why don't you buy this? Why don't you take this? Why don't you do this? So if we are alert, then we can resist that. So essentially, the process of meditation helps us to understand the difference between the mind and me. And that is extremely important. Without understanding that difference between the mind and me, usually we end up doing two things. Whenever some emotion comes up within us, we either express it or we repress it. Now, neither of them is always very healthy. If I'm angry, if I express it, I might hurt other people. Because I may speak and do things in that rage that may not be just, that may be very harsh. But at the same time, if I repress the anger, it is going to choke me from within. So we need to go beyond expressing emotions and repressing emotions to processing emotions. And that processing of emotions can be done when we are able to distance ourselves from those emotions. So that is what we can do when we start becoming spiritual. Because we can understand, okay, this emotion is coming within me. It is not that I have to reject the emotion, nor do I have to accept the emotion. I can evaluate. Okay, I become angry. Why did I become angry? Yeah, because they did this. But, you know, did they do that because of some bad intention? Or was there some misunderstanding? We process the emotions. And then we can respond much more maturely. That's why understanding that we are different from the mind is vital for our success in life, for our progress and success in life. Did I address your point? Thank you. Thank you. Any other points? Any other questions? Yes, please.
Do you think that all types of meditation are equally as beneficial?
Okay, good question. So are all types of meditation equally beneficial? Often meditation is equated with deep thinking. And that is fine. It can be any kind of deep thought can be called as meditation. But words have general meanings and they also have specific meanings. So for example, you know, if a scientist is doing some research and then they charge some battery and the battery runs out of power. Then they may say, I have run out of energy. And after a long day's work, the scientist comes back home and they tell their family member, I have run out of energy. Now, the word energy is the same, but they're used in two different contexts. You know, when the laboratory, it is used in the specific context of the particular device and the energy it has. Here it is used generically in terms of, I am tired now. So like that, in a generic sense, any kind of deep thought can be used to refer to meditation, can be called as meditation. But in a specific, when we come to spiritual circles, meditation refers to the not just the deep thinking, but thinking about spiritual reality. So, only when our thoughts rise from the material level to the spiritual level, then actually we are meditating. So now, for this meditation, there can be various starting points. So for example, some people may meditate on their breath and try to slow down their breath. That itself can calm us down. Some people may focus on a candle. Some people may focus on a light. Some people may just look at nature. And all these can help us to calm down. And that is, so we can say we are meditating, but that is meditation in the sense of deep thought. It is not meditation in the sense of spiritual thinking. For spiritual thinking, we need a spiritual stimulus. So, a spiritual stimulus can come from various sources. And mantra, when we do mantra meditation, there is the mantra is actually not just ordinary sound. It is spiritual power encased in sound. So it is spiritual power encased in sound. So when we focus on the sound of mantras, then we are not just calming our mind so that we can focus on spiritual reality. Rather, spiritual reality is becoming accessible to us. And when you talk about mantras, this mantra, for example, we chanted the Hare Krishna mantra earlier. This is also a form of addressing the Supreme Consciousness. See, we are finite consciousness and then there is infinite consciousness. So when we address the infinite consciousness, that infinite consciousness reciprocates and helps us in elevating ourselves. So just like if, say, I have to go to a top of a 10-story building, I can go up by the staircase by my own effort. But if there is electric power, I just enter into an elevator, the elevator will help me rise up. Elevator is the electric power that is there. It's a power outside me, higher than, different from me, that will help me rise up. So normally, when we meditate on different objects in this world, they can all prompt us towards spiritual thinking. But that is like climbing up a staircase, where we depend primarily on our effort to elevate ourselves. Whereas, when we focus on spiritual sound, when we focus on the sound of mantras, then those mantras are like elevators of consciousness. So just we focus on the mantra, and by focusing on the mantra, it's like entering the elevator. And the elevator rises upwards. So we'll find the spiritualization of consciousness happening much faster through mantra meditation than through other forms of meditation. Does that answer your question? Any other questions?
I suppose lastly, I just want to ask, where do you think the soul is?
Okay. Where is the soul? Yeah. Thank you. The soul is non-material. So it is not restricted in a physical sense to any particular location. The soul is basically a spark of consciousness. If I have a spark, from that spark, light radiates out to us and then it illumines. So like that, the soul is a spark of consciousness and that spark radiates consciousness all over the body. So it is because of the presence of the soul that we are conscious. Now this chair is made of ultimately the same material, same atoms and molecules that my body is made up of. But it's not conscious, I am conscious. This is because the soul is present. And in yoga, there is a description of different kinds of airs in the body. We talk about oxygen, that's the air that we breathe in. But yoga has a different model of the body, where it is described that that air inside the body itself is classified in different ways. And different forms of air perform different functions. So, for example, there is air which is used for breathing. Then we have peristalsis, you know, when we digest food. There's the air required for that. When we swing round and round, we get vertigo. So there is air which maintains equilibrium. And when we move round and round, that air gets disbalanced. And that's why we feel like falling. So the point is that these five airs, these are five kinds of airs. And these five airs act on the in the body in different ways. So in physics, you know, there are vectors, directed forces. So these five airs are like vectors. And they direct the energy, like the flow of air, in different directions. So the result, the soul exists in the body at the point where the resultant of these five vectors is zero. And usually that point lies in the region of the heart. So the soul doesn't reside in the heart. The soul resides in the region of the heart at the point where the resultant of the vector of the five airs that comes to neutral. Does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you. Very much.
Thank you. Any other questions? Yeah, please.
Have you heard about the Buddhist concept of no self, or like no soul?
Okay. Yeah. So what about the Buddhist concept of the no self? See, anattavad, as it is called. Now, I have to understand this historically, first of all. Buddhism evolved in India about 2500 years ago, primarily as a response to casteist oppression in the prevailing religion at that time. And if we saw, if we look at Buddha's life, you know, he, what he essentially taught and what he essentially propagated in terms of conduct and practice, it is in many ways similar to what was present earlier. You know, that we should explore life's spiritual dimension and we should focus on proper, nobler living. So now, at that time, he rejected the conventional sources of knowledge that were there, the yoga texts that were there at that time, various texts that were there at that time. Now they had been misunderstood and misrepresented for perpetuating the caste system. The original Vedic, original idea in the yoga text is that we all have different natures. And what is called as caste system now was actually originally based on nature. So different people have different natures and they are given occupations according to their natures. It was not meant to be a birth. It was not meant to be about discrimination. It was meant for cooperation. But anyway, the point here is that yoga, that because those texts were misunderstood, misrepresented, and when Buddha gave some a teaching of egalitarianism, of inquiry, of exploration, which was based on using human intelligence, so the existing orthodoxy of that time said, but where is this told in the Vedas, in the yoga texts? So he said, you know, if these texts are going to teach something discriminatory, then reject those texts. Now, if I decide to study physics without any physics textbooks, I cannot study physics. I need physics textbooks to study physics. Similarly, to know spirituality, we need spiritual books. But if Buddha rejected all spiritual books, then what happened? Then how does he talk? How to talk about spirituality? So he basically adopted largely a agnostic attitude toward the spiritual realm. So there's a story, you know, some people came and asked him, so are you God? Just remained silent. Are you a saint? He remained silent. Are you an angel? He remained silent. What are you? I am awake. So he gave an answer which was true, but we did not address the specific question. So basically, he remained silent about the spiritual side. He said that basically focus on ethical practice. By that the consciousness will develop and eventually spiritual understanding will dawn. So he was silent largely about the soul. But subsequent generation of Buddhist thinkers, Now, they wanted theological autonomy from the parent Hindu tradition. And that is how the idea of Anattavad. So Buddha was silent. Buddha did not say that there is no soul. Buddha was just silent about the idea of a soul. But subsequent thinkers say that he attributed to him the idea that he said there is no soul. And that becomes, it becomes a source of perplexity even for Buddhist thinkers, because Buddhism accepts reincarnation. But it doesn't accept a soul. So then the question comes up, what is it that is reincarnating? We have consciousness, and somebody else say there are past life memories where people remember, I was so-and-so person and I did so-and-so. Some of them have very accurate memories also. So there's something which is going from this life to that life. If there is no soul, then what is it that is going? So rather than seeing Anattavad as a absolute truth, what we could see it as a contextual historical development in response to a particular situation. So Buddha himself was open to philosophical understanding and inquiry. So actually, if we explore spirituality, turn inwards and explore, we can understand that there's a core to our being which is non-material. No, I'll just tell how even science points to this. That Dr. Wilder Penfield was a Nobel laureate, pioneer of neurosurgery. He wrote a book called, many books, but he wrote one of his prominent books is The Mystery of the Mind, in which he reported results of almost 40 years of experimentation done in trying to understand the self. So now researchers know that certain areas of the brain are connected with certain bodily functions. So say the frontal area of the brain is connected with motor nervous system. So for example, if a particular, this front part of the brain is activated, say the hand rises. So he had a subject and he told the subject, raise your hand. Subject raised the hand and he saw that that part of the brain was activated. Put your hand down, put his hand down. That part of the brain was deactivated. Then after that, he used external probes, electrodes to activate that part of the brain. And the hand went up. So what happened? He asked the subject, what happened? He says, my hand went up. Did you raise your hand? No, I didn't. You did. Then afterwards, he deactivated. The hand fell down. What happened? He says, my hand fell down. Did you put your hand down? No, I didn't. You did. So now, while repeating this experiment of by which the hand goes up and hand goes down, now, Penfield also activated other parts of the brain. Now, no matter whichever part of the brain he activated, no part of the brain ever gave the person the feeling that I am raising my hand. Different parts of the brain, when activated, did different things. Some memories got stimulated, some other reactions came in the body. But nowhere did the person feel that I am doing this when a particular part of the brain was activated. So, to understand the implications of this experiment, say consider there's a computer and there's a printer attached to it. So, now in my computer, I press the print button and then the printer hand starts moving. Now, it's my computer, I can press the print button and the printer hand will move. But suppose you come there and you press the print button, then also the printer hand will move. So, now there is a connection between the print button and the print hand. Similarly, there's a connection between, say, the frontal lobe of the brain and the motion of the hand. Now, in the second case, it was Dr. Penfield who came and pressed the print button. It was he activated that part of the brain. In the first case, who activated it? Who activated in the first case? That there is certainly some person who is activating who says, I raised my hand, and then later saying, I did not raise my hand. So, after 40 years of brain researching the brain, Dr. Penfield concluded that the source of consciousness is extracerebral. It's extracerebral. So, that source of consciousness which exists outside the body, outside the brain, that is the soul. There has to be a locus of consciousness from which consciousness is being transmitted. So, Anattavada, as I said, is more of a historical response rather than a timeless truth. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Any other questions?
Thank you so much for speaking today.
Thank you very much for your attention. Hare Krishna. You can read.
We can have maybe two of us go to the same time.